Sir.
Hmm.
Welcome back.
Thank you.
Could you share with the readership some of your recent experiences while in China, and tell us what most deeply impressed you while you were there?
Well, I think first of all, just the sheer numbers of China, I mean, about 1 billion people, and everywhere you go, even the smallest city, the guide says to you, we're a very small, humble city, we have 4 million people. And there were many of those, you know, quite apart from the scenery. There were other things that were interesting, the re-establishment of our culture, which was badly damaged during the Cultural Revolution, coming back up, including, I understand, about 350 new Buddhist temples.
Really?
Not new, but refurbished. It was established by some negotiation with the Panchen Lama. That in itself didn't impress me, because a lot of those are just sheer for tourism, tourist places, but also the establishment of culture. But people themselves have, of course, much more into a kind of native capitalism, and to get back at the economic level.
Things have loosened up enough.
Oh, very much, yeah. So in travel, it's loosened up. And,
where did you go? Where did you visit the port cities?
Flew from Hong Kong to Canton. I don't give the Chinese name. And then to Weilin, mm-hmm. for the Karst Formation of the limestone mountain hills, which are mm-hmm. peculiarly shaped. And then from there to Shanghai.
It's a large city, eh?
Very, very large city. And the Fushan, the Silk Center, then to Nanjing, which is the old southern capital.
Mm-hmm.
And then we embarked on the Yangtze River, and we have several, quite a number of days on the Yangtze River, through the gorges, mm-hmm. through the mini gorges and the maxi gorges, the large gorges. And then to Chongqing, which was the capital in exile, or in sense in exile, from the Japanese.
Oh, yeah.
Yes, Kuomintang, capital during the war.
Was that deeply inland? Was that
yes, it's very, very deeply inland. It's a starting a mountain type scenery. And then we flew from there to Xi'an, which was the terracotta,
mm-hmm.
Magnificent terracotta army.
The one that they uncovered?
Yeah, that's right. That was spectacular. And then to 4 days in very deep seeing of Beijing, Peking. And then from there, we flew over to...
To the Great Wall?
Yes. My second time. But the whole impression was the sheer industry and the ongoing effect of the Chinese Revolution. And more of an equalization among the people. More respect also among the people. Mm-hmm. The atmosphere is very friendly, very open, very friendly, and very determinedly commercial, which was a bit of a shock. But they're just recovering from the Cultural Revolution, which they had about, they estimated, 40-50% of their antique cultures that were visible, destroyed, the buried ones that of course have been untouched. And hundreds of thousands of young people killed in the process before the army clamped down. That's right. And there's a book, Mao and the Cultural Revolution, which is quite a good part of you and gives you the atmosphere. But now it's relatively peaceful and going ahead.
Did your trip to China?
I think they transcended, they're not. If, in a sense, the Chinese people ever were religious, they're certainly not religious now. They have had the feet, you know, firmly based on the good earth.
Marxism is more or less their religion?
It's something more from the top, which sort of filters down. Of course, it's still a dictatorship of the party, not like so much of the proletariat, because in fact there isn't very much of a proletariat arising in the in China, and the peasants and the and there's one of their big problems is the split between city people and country people and peasants. I'm afraid the sort of cities are winning. That's the sort of thing that everybody wants to get in the city. There are innumerable problems that they have on population. And the population one, they have one family, one child. And then, oh, yeah. And they have, well, they get all the credits for education and their supplementary benefits. You see huge billboards with the parents and a girl child trying to, it's all right, you know, to have a girl, because there's still, perhaps, still a remnant of, killing off the girl child, abandoning her in the countryside. Mm-hmm. The peasants, peasantry are allowed more children.
They are?
Yeah. They're still trying to eliminate that, but people in the city are very much indoctrinated by one child, one for one family.
Did your trip influence this new direction that you've taken?
Yes, because the thing that I've seen is you have a sense that there are billions of people. You simply have the effect that masses of people, uninfluenced by any, or certainly superstitious, by anything religious, there's all superstitious remnants in the country. But you have very much the feeling of the people that's working for here and now on earth for material benefit. The whole thrust of it is for them. It's a great dynamic.
And the alleviation of physical.
Yeah, and the alleviation of physical suffering. Not so much stress on alleviation of emotional or mental suffering. But at the very basic level, they've done wonders.
Mm-hmm.
And then I just juxtaposition that about in North America, where you have small groups of people who are into something and into doing a bit of meditation, more or less without for themselves and perhaps the benefit of a few people around them. But it doesn't really necessarily influence the coming into being of a new society. So this went through my mind, and that's the reason why I had a very deep going review of where I feel people should be at. But the important thing is to build up a spiritual cadre similar to the Communist Party, mm-hmm. cadre, which is out in the society, actually affecting the mores and the structure and the principles of the society
mm-hmm.
by direct action. China is controlled by cadre of people,
mm-hmm.
and they have deep influence. And I'm not saying that that's evil or bad or anything of that nature, but they build up a group of people dedicated out in mm-hmm. throughout the populace, working with the populace.
Well, it's the leadership, isn't it?
It's the leadership mm-hmm. principle, and that's why I think that I'd like to emphasize more and more the building up sort of equal cadre
mm-hmm.
that is involved at the dimensions that they can give with some guiding principles
mm-hmm.
that they rule of conduct of enactment of principles in the world mm-hmm. in the ways that people can be involved. And without the spiritual cadre, I think the group is little groups are very vulnerable.
And perhaps narcissistic.
And narcissistic, of course. This is the big debate in my mind. When teaching, some people gravitate, and they're very narcissistic, and they're getting something for them, but then it's dead-ended.
Mm-hmm. Well, there was a recent debate in the newsletter. One person wrote about how people should be out and not up at the temple meditating, they should be out on Java Street in the soup kitchen.
Yeah.
And then the householder wrote and said, well, I'm a parent of two children, and my life is, I've already made these commitments to family.
Mm-hmm.
And for many people, that's a real deep conflict. They want to be able to apply the teaching that they've learned in a very direct way, but because of their commitments to family, jobs, et cetera, they've limited themselves and feel quite guilty about that.
Well, the...
Because there's always that
challenge. The first way that you affect this society is that you personally are an exemplar of it. And if you are in a family situation, you work to put into practice those principles in the family. If you can go further than that, it's not merely just being with the family and commitment, but how you're committed to the family to enact or carry through certain principles. Once you have that, if there is extra time and space, and maybe you'll discover some, that will break also the narcissism of the family. The too introverted focus on the family. Although I agree, that's where, if you can't do that, then you ought not to be out of soup kitchens or anything else.
Right,
you
can't neglect the family.
Yeah, you know, you've got to be able to do that first, and then I think also make an effort to get a broader view, because you do meet other people, shopping or at work or so-and-so. And I don't think there's anyone who's just living only in one, and never goes out of the house, and only sees their family. You do see other people, you do meet with other people, and that's where you should be enacting a principle.
In anything that you're doing.
But I want to stress again, if you can't do it at home, you can't do it outside. So, I don't see any actual split about that. I sometimes think that it can be a convenient excuse, an over family orientation, but could be, not always, but could be. I'm just afraid to go out there. I don't want to get involved out there. I think I don't see the larger view of the direction of humanity. I don't want to see that. I want to, pull the blankets up around myself and the nest. If you don't have a loving nest, then I can't see what you're taking out to others.
One question that came up in our discussions before was, this year is the 20th anniversary of your return to Canada from the monastery as a teacher. You've been teaching for 20 years. Do you have any reflections about how your role as a teacher has changed through those years? Do you see a change in either the student's relationship to you or your relationship to the students?
Well, that requires some thought. I haven't actually looked at it in those terms because it's the nature of any organism or any life thing to grow. I think that I've personally moved away from the Eastern... you see, the West suffers maybe from a doctrinal dogmatism. And the East suffers from a sort of a personal relationship with the teacher, which is sort of they cast in rather the authoritarian dogmatic term. As if people are looking for either assurance in doctrinal exposition or an assurance in a personal relationship. And both of these come under authorities. What I have felt is rubbish, that many good ideas don't get enacted or don't get picked up because of the resistance to the unresolved authority conflicts that that people have, either from the standpoint of the religious organization or from the standpoint of people receiving it.
Mm-hmm. There has been a shift.
Where I would like to get to is to get away completely from Eastern organization terms.
What would that do? I mean, to what end would that?
Well, I think you get a much more reflective hearing rather than I hear and I obey.
Mm-hmm.
And the beings might know why they're actually involved in this and that, the principles that they're involved in. We get more emphasis rather than the emotional relationship to the teacher, which I think is very, very important point to get to transcend that. I have a lot of thoughts on the subject, but they're not entirely formulated.
Well, there's been a lot of discussion among many of the older students who have been with you for 15 or 20 years who've come to a point where they really, it's increasingly difficult to sit in a class and be in the position of passively receiving information.
Yes.
Most of the attitude is along the lines of, I haven't gotten the message now, when am I going to get it?
Yes.
And basically my responsibility is to work.
Mm-hmm.
But nevertheless, the love for the teacher remains.
Mm-hmm.
So there's a whole new quality of relationship that's developing,
mm-hmm.
and we were wondering if you could please, in any way, comment on that. How does the relationship between the teacher and the student grow over a long period of time?
Well, the important thing of just taking a very classical response, the important thing is in the manifestation of love towards the teacher is to do practice. Not necessarily at the I hear, smiling presence type of thing. But whether they're activated to take principles into their work and through their work to influence other people. There's a lot of people who are always around who sit and hear, and they can go on hearing and hearing and hearing and hearing, but there has to come a point when you put it into practice. That's the only deep and abiding manifestation of love, is to in fact take something that you understand and apply it. It's not necessarily honoring a teacher always to be in his presence without doing anything. Again, and that's what I feel is a great weight, is the sort of dead endism of teaching, unless you can take that, get the realization from it, and move it out. This is, a sort of infantile dependency number. And certainly the principles are being declared over and over and over again from innumerable directions, ad infinitum, maybe for some ad nauseum. but they must take that there. Of course, somebody's going to feel guilty at a certain point by sitting there and being in a position of receiving. Because something's trying to tell them, you should be giving. This is tedious for me, I can assure you.
Yes, I would think so, that after you see the same faces for 15 years.
That's right, exactly.
You probably hope to see new faces.
Exactly.
An old face every now and then, hi.
Yes, hello, how are you today, right? What are you doing? No, it is for me personally. People which I call Klingon. I like to give, but there's a point where I don't like to give.
Mm-hmm.
Most people don't realize that. I feel, well, it's repetitive. And, I must say that I have a lot of ideas which are for me, new and exciting and so on, and new dimensions that I would like to get involved in, and I feel that I have to go over repetitive ground over and over again because people don't.
Well, I've always
message.
Been impressed by your implementation.
Yeah. Well, I've reached the end of patience. Thank you.
Yeah, I have another question to ask you, and that has to do with feminism. And there are some, particularly feminists, who think that the most important movement in the 20th century has been the movement of women to autonomy, because it's like the liberation of half the population of the planet.
Mm-hmm.
And most organized religions, including the Buddha Dharma, as an organized institution, it's institutionalized misogyny. In other words, there is the institutionalization of the degradation of women. How are you going to integrate feminism into your new teaching? Is there a conscious effort to embrace the feminist doctrine and the idea of
I can't say that I can embrace feminist doctrine, because I'm not sure what that is. What you're
intending
to
that.
Okay, well, I've read, actually. I've read quite a bit.
Among
feminists, there are many, many different viewpoints and ways. All I'm concerned in personally is one point that I insist on training women in speaking, in communication. And that's one thing that I can do. And I have pledged to do that, and I intend to do that. And, you know, I have a very confident will about things. Because I think that's the key, to articulate, for women to articulate. It's not for me to control what they are articulating, but I articulate and I pretend. Path of articulation, expression of whether it's anything from the frustrations or resentments up to very positive things that women want to get involved in. But the key that I see is the one contribution, at least, and maybe others, of course.
Mm-hmm.
And therefore, from that, I expect that if there is any new compassionate cadre or order or whatever it is in being, that women teach, preach,
articulate,
etc. And I'd rather like break it from that standpoint, or break into that dimension.
Mm-hmm.
I think I'd even agree with you that at least up to this year, that movement is probably the most revolutionary in existence up to this point, or the most important point during this era. I think it's going to go further than that.
Much further.
Much further than that. But perhaps
the planet should be feminized, because one of the questions that has been plaguing me for quite a long time, personally, is 97% of all violent crimes are committed by men, and they've been mutually slaughtering each other for 8 millennia. And one wonders, what is the root of this antisocial behavior? And my own view about feminism is not to complain about the men, but to do something to offset that... impetus. But I'm wondering, what can be done? How do you see the future unfolding in terms of that particular behavior pattern being eradicated? And what is its root?
Well, all this goes back to China in a way. The thing that has to be done is for the overcoming of war, etc. And I'd just like to put in, I believe people should be involved in the peace movement, because that's the other. That's another very, very big issue. I think that it grows from a very simple thing, which is Chinese people have learned to respect one another, broken down to not entirely, but to a great extent, the class system where there was disrespect from above to below, etc., and false respect from below to above, and all that conditioning as an aftermath of the Cultural Revolution, has in fact moved on into mutual respect. And
also perhaps an emphasis on cooperation rather than competition.
Yes, that has come into being. And I think that this is the feeling key to it, if you want. And in order for, that's why I think that women attaining, it's a little more than just a woman attaining certain men's roles, you know, such as maybe in business or in science and so on. But that's part of it, because that comes in, that comes nearer to, well, you know, they're successful, therefore we respect. You know, but might either have one or two reactions, either be jealous and attacking that. But that time is also going. The whole respect motif is coming up more and more. That's the sort of vague thing, but that's the key word, I think. It's the mutual respect. Before there can be mutual cooperation, there has to be a feeling for the other being in terms of respect. This respect aspect goes through at the religious level also, because I really feel, for example, whether you publish it or not, that Tibetan teachers don't actually respect students. You know, they're very much down there to sort of lower creatures. And this is always something that's very much troubled me. I mean, A, on one hand, you're aware there are deficiencies in being, but you should respect the potential of being. So unless you respect the potential of women first, and then their achievements, I don't see how you're actually going to come to a resolution of it. The other point is, what I have... I have been reading various books which are to me exciting for more women authors, but and which I respect their writing. But some of them in, for example, histories of women's women's contributions to history is a very key, pivotal thing.
Marvelous.
It's sort of hidden. It's a bit hidden.
You read that, Elizabeth Gould
Davies. Yeah.
Marvelous.
Yeah.
I mean, it's like eye-opening.
Yes. Well, I've been reading the studies basically in England. The women's contributions, more or less, how they lived, and how they not only influenced or were not allowed to be to influence, and so on. But all there's a lot of things that are going to sort of fall all together. I think they're all interconnected. Freudianism is going to fall at the same time. Darwinianism is going to fall. And the fiction of the superiority of this or that class or sex of being might fall too. And they're somehow all interconnected. I don't know if you can intuit that. There's
yes, it is.
So many more exciting views coming into being at the standpoint of evolution and the standpoint of psychology and so on. I think capitalism cannot, and even sort of false communism won't fall until the respect among people is established. I mean, even the dictatorship of the party is saying it's kind of an elitist thing, which is all interconnected, you know, it's not a true communism or a true religion until there is the realization of the dharma of interdependence.
So you're saying
it's interdependent.
That when there's a recognition of that interdependence, there'd be a decrease in the interdependence.
Exactly, yeah. Interdependent. And you go back to very classic Buddhist things, I mean, you know, impermanence, we're all here for a fleeting time, and interconnectedness of all beings, the mutual support of all beings. And the fact that there isn't a real abiding entity, including feminism, not an abiding entity.
No.
See, it's a need of this present time.
Exactly.
But what is going to lead to?
It's a vehicle.
Yes, a vehicle of liberation.
You once said that a woman has a more difficult condition to overcome than a male, but that once she does that, her progress on the path is more rapid. Would you elaborate upon that thought?
Well, I think you see it sort of comfyism versus struggle.
Yeah, right, either way.
You know, I'm sort of in most male dealers are very comfy.
Yeah.
There's no need to get liberated. We are liberated, as you say. And therefore, the process of liberation is very, 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 very slow, because it's almost from like a, you know, the old classic teaching of bliss versus pain, you know.
Mm-hmm.
First of all, the slaves got to realize that they are enslaved, and then they struggle for freedom, and they have a crisis, and then they get through. Once they get through, they know what freedom is. I don't think most of the men realize that they're enslaved. See, from the man's standpoint, because they're comfy.
The enslavement is their condition.
Yeah, it's not obvious.
Mm-hmm.
Not as obvious as the woman put down that's happened historically.
Right, if you're
and so therefore, she can react, and she can get resentment, and she can
right.
get liberated. And then she can feel the dimensions of freedom,
mm-hmm.
and feel this very directly, that all such possibilities are open to her.
Right.
But the man, he's in comfy.
Right.
He doesn't need to struggle because he doesn't believe he's enslaved.
Consciousness raising sessions for men. You know?
Well, I think I will, because I'm getting more and more concerned about that. From what I've seen in and through the Dharma Center and many other centers and people, but. I've met is women are struggling and the men are not
mm-hmm.
in so many ways, unless they have a definite emotional problem that they want.
Right.
But it's in miniature, it's an emotional problem. It's not the
right.
properly pervading put down.
Do you find I'm sure that you must, because I've always seen you as a radical.
Mm.
You're a very radical
mm.
being.
Haven't
you found that people who are involved in any kind of organized teaching or
mm-hmm.
religion
mm-hmm.
are inherently conservative? It's kind of like a social and political conservatism that, I mean, I don't know if you found this, but...
I wouldn't necessarily agree with that, because I think you're talking time. You're talking, you know, the beginning of something and then the middle
mm-hmm.
range of
yeah.
it, and then the decadency that all movements go off into.
Right.
But at the foundation of, I'll say, the Quakers and so on, they were
very radical.
They were very radical
right.
at the beginning, and in a way you need, or you could debate it, but it seems to be that the people have a need of a form to express their radicalism.
Mm-hmm.
And then it can get, you know, in those movements also, there comes, like the Franciscan Order, the establishment of the Franciscan Order, and then you get the conserving of these valuable
mm-hmm.
points. And then it becomes, eventually, a hindrance for the new. Up to this point in history, no one has ever overcome the fact that a plant which has a form has this burst and then a stable period and then it withers and dies. And I mean, if you're providing you understand that from the beginning, I don't think you're deeply entrapped
mm-hmm.
In it. Mao Zedong tried to do a permanent revolution, a permanent revolution. And he came a cropper, absolutely,
mm-hmm.
from all sorts of directions.
His
greatest failure was that he was too far, in a sense, perhaps in the future.
Well, he was very radical.
He was very radical, but he thought the people were
right.
radical, and that the revolution would go on.
All over the world. I mean, it was happening
yeah.
in the United States.
Yeah.
It was happening
yeah.
in France.
Yeah. But then
but he's the only country that said, "Okay,
yeah.
take
clock,
over."
Yeah, that's right. But the clocks, you see, the people were not at that point apparently ready.
Right.
They resisted taking over.
Exactly.
It's a historic moment, if not with
mm-hmm.
the rhythm.
Mm-hmm.
And eventually they had the army. Had to bring an army, which
right.
was an absolute. Conservative
mm-hmm.
thing. I mean, the armies are the most conservative force on earth, if you look at it. They love everything in order and in
right.
place and no chaos whatsoever. And it was the time to consolidate the gains that they had made.
Mm-hmm.
And
the pulses of history move that way. I've had a frustrated radicalism for a long period of time. It was left merely to me without consideration of people. I would have banished the Tibetans long ago and quite a number of other things. But they did have a form, a place to understand, a kind of a structure.
Well, they also had a great teacher.
And had great teachers.
Great teacher.
But there is now is the time to be, in fact, much more efficient.
Mm-hmm.
Much more cutting through. And we have achieved this in the new meditational technique.
Did you read the precepts that
no,
Jackie
I haven't.
Gave you?
No.
But then I might like to have your permission to print it in part in mm-hmm. the newsletter to perhaps give
I would pull
a meditation instruction to our readers. You know?
Yeah, well, I would pull two or three people to see that it's been done, right?
Yeah.
The hearers.
Because I read it and it needs a little more clarification.
I think so.
I'm
I
from
think
a person from who's not deceased.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, well, directly, you know, there's a lot of inflection in the voice and this and that
right.
and the other that give the correct emphasis to it. So I would suggest you do that, and then I'm trying to get through to a point where the meditation is more efficient. We can cut through; it's much more direct. It's something that people understand. All the wise men are doing.
It's not an enormous belief system.
No, it's not a belief system,
right?
Because either you experience it right then and there or you don't, and that's it. So it's not subject to belief, it's direct experience. And that will be the main thrust of the meditation part of the teaching. I will teach other things that are side numbers, in a sense, that will give flexibility to people to practice other ways. But that's in a sense where it's at,
mm-hmm.
and that's come from the, I've seen the struggles of people with the classic system, and
mm-hmm.
So on. Basically there, I'm trying to say that they can strip down to a much more efficient, much more direct experience teaching. And they don't have to be with any label. Anyone can do any. They don't have a label or a belief system behind it. They will experience it directly liberated.
And it's a direct practice.
Yes, if it isn't possible, forget it. It should be experienced as directly liberation in every session. And if they don't experience that, then they've got the, either the instruction,
mm-hmm.
Well, they've got the instruction wrong. That's one of the results which apply.
Well, thank you, sir.
Anyway, that's some aspect.
Do you have anything else you'd like to say to your
no.
the vast body
no.
of mind?
No,
out there?
No.
Terrific. Thank you very much.
Except for the vast body of minds to realize that they are a vast body of mind and therefore are capable of things.
Mm-hmm.
And I mean things. They have enough belief in their capacity.
Yeah. Their power.
Hmm?
Their power, particularly the power of numbers.
Well, I hope that's
yes.
something.
Oh, yes. It's interesting, you know, that the United Nations did some studies.
Appreciate the whole richness of life that the other dimension. I mean, I deliberately often to think that to see other dimensions,
mm-hmm.
and those dimensions which can be shared with other people. When I go to China, for that reason, there are other people.
Well, it's what you said this morning. Whatever you do, you have this attitude.
Yeah.
May this further the awakening of self
mm-hmm.
and others, right?
Mm-hmm. I feel fitting for people who are like the focus is excessively on themselves, or excessively on their families, if that's the only criteria, and they're losing thereby. They're losing
mm-hmm.
their families. I believe that yourself should be treated with respect, your family should be treated with respect, but the vehicle of enlightenment is to make an effort to open the door of perception to other people and to other creatures. I mean, for that,
mm-hmm.
that reason, I mean, if you went to saw how animals thought, you might, put down human chauvinism. I mean, there are other chauvinisms that have to be put down.
and an all-embracing idea. And enlightenment, I think people are erroneously on the idea it's a merely introspective thing. Because even the, like the great mantra of Gata Gata is, yes, we look within, we see what's happening, but we look without. And it's not a pious idea. The actual fearful of enlightenment is to be compassionate and involved. And if I may say so, the only one is going to bring a being through the truth to work.
Well, when you think of the people who are involved in Greenpeace, like, you know, the people in Greenpeace, like, that's, it's so, I mean, that really does further everything. It furthers life on the planet. It's a wholly nourishing and positive act. You know, and they're not sitting in meditation, not doing anything formal, but they're wonderful.
But you can have both.
Mm-hmm.
You actually can have both.
Yes.
Because unless you are introspective or reflective or recollective or meditative or contemplative, you are in danger that you haven't got the quality to bring it up. The one direct way is awareness. And as Krishna mentioned, it's choices. That means it's not just sitting in meditation, it's out in meditation. Being in an aware state, whether you're balancing between the within and the without.
Mm-hmm.
And that's important to get through. There's a lot of people who are in the business, but the quality,
right.
They have unresolved.
They're generated by anger or
anger,
resentment or some whatever.
Being a
right,
peaceful,
exactly.
Being a
exactly.
Involved in the peacemaking.
Right.
I mean, energy was actually effective. The people who are in states of anger, et cetera, are ultimately with a feeling that they are not effective.
Mm-hmm.
But people who are peaceful,
like the Quakers, for instance, in
the
Quakers,
they do far more,
powerful.
Far further, far more influential,
mm-hmm.
and also they believe in it. Until you yourself are peaceful, you don't really believe in the peace movement. You don't believe in its possibility of its success,
mm-hmm.
because you haven't experienced the success of it. If you yourself
right.
are a resolved being, you get the point, then you have evidence that peace can come into being.
Peace is possible.
It's possible. And it starts from that. And to a peaceful community, so an association of people that you are related to, that you are relating to them in not working out your aggression. Mm-hmm. I hope for the so-called students that they will realize peace within them, right? Then it's able to have dialogue and peace, not unresolved infantility. I put it that way.
You really did win. Well, it's always nice to see you.
Oh, you haven't heard radicalism yet.
Well, I'm always open to it. I love it, you know.
Maybe another edition further down the line, you really get to know, really, more and more, I think, and we're really, really shocked. But you see, I've had a discipline to hold back a whole lot. That's quite a lot.
Yes, you have. Is that because of the fact that you were, like, formally inducted into robes and had
well,
these responsibilities? Exactly.
I'm finally being forced to the point that I, you know, more than anything else, a loyalty to the thing. And it doesn't come in any form. Much of that Tibetan stuff is just anathema. The fact that that was the only thing that there was. It was a whole comprehensive
mm-hmm.
system. And history, of experiential history involved in it. It had richness of a practice that had been practiced down through centuries.
Mm-hmm.
The treasury of that.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas what this is stepping far more into the unknown. We don't know where this is going.
Mm-hmm.
But we have at least the first major weapon. And I'm saying weapon and attack.
Right.
I believe it's the attack. And that is just the direct meditation. Cut through.
Right.
And it's about it's a time that these things must be, that war has to be attacked. You know,
that's right.
Poof, poof, you know?
It has to be directly attacked.
Directly attacked. and the old religious system also contain great dangers for
Were you aware that that remember the Achille Lauro incident in the Mediterranean where they shot this man, Mr. Klinghoffer?
Yes,
we were on that boat.
Yes.
Peter Wilkening reminded me of that. That was a boat from South Africa to New Zealand.
That's absolutely correct. And that's the real world out there. That's happened. It's not to despise, you understand, for doing a formal meditation, but you must make the formal meditation as efficient and short and brief. I want enlightenment speedily and for the sake of
others.
Beings. You know, not just sit there for year after year after year.
Stagnating.
You know. Well, I don't say you're sad.
Well, not to worry.
The growth is far too slow. No, I haven't that negative view. you're not stagnant. You are growing, but the rates of growth are not sufficient for the grand awakening of mankind. It is growing. There are some trees that take about, you know, 100 years, you know, I think that their growth is rather like when it's so beautiful, it's like one of these plants in Japan, you know, the growth just so high.
A little bonsai tree.
Bonsai tree. You know, you want to be a bonsai tree, you want to be a big spreading oak tree, you know, it's more shade, more